I received a liver from a deceased donor. So while my life was being saved, someone else's family was losing a life. And so carrying that has been both like very difficult, but also kind of a fresh perspective. I wasn't able to advocate for myself before, but when I woke up, I was like, I need to talk to somebody about how I've been feeling and I need to get some help. Somebody gave a gift so big and so meaningful here that I can't waste it.
Welcome to the Living Transplant Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of the transplant program at Toronto General Hospital. I'm your host, Candace. Each episode, we share the powerful stories from transplant recipients and living donors, along with insights and education from leading medical professionals. Today, we're honored to share the story of someone whose resilience shows us what inner strength really looks like. Mary faced years of navigating complex mental health challenges, hidden burdens that often go unseen and sometimes misunderstood. Through courage and unwavering determination, she worked towards emotional healing and stability. Just as she found her footing, Mary was confronted with an unexpected medical emergency that required a life-saving liver transplant. Her journey is a testament to quiet bravery, one that involves self-advocacy in a system that sometimes doesn't always see the person behind the patient. Today, Mary joins us to speak candidly about what it's like to receive a transplant while managing mental health challenges, the barriers to care, and the profound power of choosing hope day after day. A note for listeners, this episode includes discussions about mental health challenges, and these topics can be difficult, so please take care while listening. If you or someone you love is facing mental health challenges, please remember you're not alone. In Ontario, Connects Ontario offers free, confidential 24/7 support and referrals. Call 1-866-531-2600 or visit connectsontario.ca for help anytime. You can also find community support and resources through the Canadian Mental Health Association Ontario at ontario.cmha.ca. Please enjoy. And now it is my pleasure to have Mary R. join us today. Thank you so much for joining us, Mary.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for asking me to be of service in this capacity.
Amazing. I'm wondering if you can tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so my name is Mary. I grew up in Toronto. And for the most part, I had like a very privileged life. You know, I always had food on the table and a roof over my head. I had loving parents and a very privileged education. So from the outside, you know, everything always looked like I was living this very pleasant and perfectly normal life. On the inside, however, you know, I never really felt like I belonged. I always felt like there was something kind of missing internally. And over time, I've come to understand that I really carry like three core beliefs about myself. The first is not being good enough. The second is not being worthy of secure love and attachment. And the third is just feeling like I am wrong, whether that was being wrong about the things I like, wrong about the emotions I had, or just wrong the fact that I was even here. And so I've kind of always had those feelings kind of fluttering in the background throughout the course of my life.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, heavy thoughts for a kid to grow up with. And I mean, thinking especially the first thought that you said there is like not feeling enough. I think we have a lot of things out there now that talk about this. You know, a lot of kids go through this and a lot of us feel that not enough part, and we put so much pressure on ourselves and in not ever feeling like we're ever gonna achieve what we've put on ourselves to achieve, and never feeling enough when, like you said, outside looks different than the inside, right? It's, yeah, that's a big one. And then also always feeling wrong. I mean, walking around in your body, feeling like no matter what, you're not doing the right thing or not what you think is the right thing. And that is, three core beliefs that are, you know, the opposite of what we want people to think about themselves and feel, and how difficult that would be, you know, walking around with that. And I'm wondering, you know, the length of time that you held those things, was there a turning point or, you know, something that happened or a series of moments that made you think, you know, I need to get myself some support so that I can feel better about myself, or I can feel enough, or I can feel like I'm not wrong all of the time, when somebody like myself from the outside would likely tell you, oh my goodness, of course, no to all of these things, but it's not real unless you believe it yourself, right?
I always tried to find things that could help me kind of cope with how I was feeling or not feel the way that I was feeling. And so when I was younger, you know, the first instance I can think of trying to like reach for something that made me feel better was like taking a look at my peers and the people around me and thinking like, oh, if I could change the way that I look, then like I'll make friends and I'll be happy. And in doing that, I developed an eating disorder, and then that worked for a time. And then, you know, slowly but surely it didn't work. And so I then started to reach for other things I thought were going to make me feel better. Like self-harm, which again worked for a time until it didn't work anymore. And then by the time I was in my early teenage years, I discovered alcohol. And that was like the first thing that really allowed me to just like take a breath and be like, oh, wow, like if I put alcohol into my body, I don't have to feel this way anymore. Mm-hmm. And so for a lot of people in those teenage years, like alcohol is a very social thing. It's something like you want to go out with your friends and you want to drink and you want to have fun. And for me, you know, I did those things, but it was never about that. It was always about like, what can I do that is going to allow me to like not feel this way anymore? Mm-hmm. And so when I discovered alcohol, I took that and I ran with it. Again, I ran with it right up until the point that it just wasn't working that way anymore. Mm-hmm. And I got to a point where, you know, I was sitting at home one day and I realized I could drink so much tonight that I don't wake up tomorrow. And for a moment, that thought didn't scare me. And then about 30 seconds later, I was like, oh, wow, that's not good. And so the next morning, that was the first time that I kind of reached out for help and said, you know, I've got all of these things going on in my life and I don't know what to do. Can you please help me?
I mean, coming to that realization and that place where, you know, you woke yourself up to that, knowing that you had to reach out and find something outside of what your coping mechanisms had been up until that point. You know, how did you find, was it a psychologist? Was it family support? Was it, you know, what was it that you woke up and said, oh my goodness, you know, this is not an okay place. I might be going down a place where I won't wake up again.
Yeah. So it was actually, I was in the middle of a set of exams and I just realized, you know, I couldn't keep going the way that I was going. And so I actually reached out to someone. I reached out to the vice dean of my school at the time and I kind of sat down with him and I told him very frankly, I got honest for like the first time in a while. And I was like, this is what I've been experiencing. Like, can you help me? And so he put me in touch with my school's like psych support systems and social support systems. And that kind of began my journey to recovery.
Mm. Wow.
And it was a really meaningful, experience. And I was able to get quite a bit of support. But what I found over time was that, you know, I was going to these doctors and going to these people that were all suggested. And I kind of found that like the response was, oh, well, of course you're feeling the way that you're feeling. You're drinking this much. You need to stop drinking and you'll feel better. And so I did. I got sober and I, you know, I found a really solid recovery program and I did the work that was suggested. And, you know, for a time I did start to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
But as, you know, the alcohol exited my body and as I continued my sobriety journey, those really deep core beliefs and those feelings of just, you know, not wanting to be here anymore, like flooded back to the surface. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no one was really willing to take a look at whether there was something going on past the addiction, right? Like the addiction was front and center and it was so easy to say, oh, well, this is how, like, why you're feeling the way that you're feeling.
Right.
And so even in early sobriety, I didn't really trust that if I went to a doctor and I said, hey, this is the way that I'm feeling,
mm-hmm.
that I was going to get a response that was different from, of course, you're feeling that way. Look at how you're drinking.
Right. So instead of understanding those core beliefs that you have grown up with, they're almost blaming it on the coping mechanisms that you had been using and blaming this on the alcohol versus digging deeper into why did you get there in the first place?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. And so at that point, you know, where physically, you know, you were dealing with that piece, but mentally you haven't found something that has changed that those core beliefs or how you were feeling. How did you then, I mean, it's amazing to hear you talk at each of these phases, because it's so like so much self-realization that you had to go through to get to each of these places. And I mean, such strength and honesty with yourself and brutal honesty that you would really have to give yourself to get to that next phase. And a lot of advocacy, like listening to you say, you know, they heard this piece, but they didn't hear that piece. What took it to the next level of saying, okay, thank you for this support, because yes, I did need that piece, but we're not done yet. I still need more.
For me, like the turning point was my transplant. In the days leading up to my transplant, you know, I was carrying all of those same feelings, and I was really at a place where, like, and I'll clarify, I never had any active suicidal ideation. Like, I never had a plan of wanting to take my own life, but I did have this like very deep feeling that, you know, I just can't keep living the way that I'm feeling. And mm-hmm. I was exhausted from feeling the way that I was feeling. And I just, you know, didn't want to be here anymore. And so I wasn't really paying much attention to how I was treating myself, let's put it that way. And I wasn't paying much attention to what I was putting in my body. And I woke up one morning and I couldn't stand up. I was incredibly dizzy. And I just had this gut feeling. I was like, something is not right.
Mm-hmm.
And I called 911 and I made my way to a hospital, and I was told that I was in liver failure.
Wow.
And, you know, my memories of this time are a little bit blurry because I was fading, you know, in and out of consciousness. But I remember when one of the doctors finally said, you know, it looks like you might need a transplant. I just remember the first thing I cared about saying was, okay, oh my God, I've been sober for 2 years and I'm not in this position because I relapsed.
Right.
And that was the only thing that I just wanted to repeat like over and over again, because I was really right. scared. And the only thing I could think of that mattered in that moment was the fact that I was sober.
And did you think that that was going to change how you would be treated by the people who were trying to help you and take care of you, like the healthcare system, basically? Did you think that that was going to impact their thoughts or your treatment?
Absolutely. I thought that was going to be like the defining feature of whether I got help or not. And not because of any, you know, prior experience I had had with the hospital, or not because of any prior experience I had had with doctors, but just because my very basic understanding of transplants and addiction from the media was, if you are not sober, you don't qualify for a transplant.
Right.
And so the only thing I cared about was making sure that they knew that I was sober, because I thought that would give me a chance.
Wow. And I mean, when you were told you needed this transplant, did you understand how sick you were and like how close you were to knocking on death's door at that time?
I think to a certain extent I did. But honestly, for the most part, like, it didn't feel real. Like, yeah. Unlike so many transplant patients who are waiting months or years or, you know, decades sometimes to receive an organ, my transplant journey, you know, it was maybe 72 hours between me coming into the hospital and me having my transplant. So it was very quick, and there wasn't a lot of time to actually process what was happening.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, now in hindsight, looking back, I mean, the reason why it happened that fast was because of, how sick you were and how high that need was for you to have that transplant, right? But I mean, even I had quite a long time before I waited for my kidney, but when I was put on dialysis, it was somewhat similar to that, like not understanding how close I was to dying without that treatment and being told like, no, you're getting this within the next few hours. You're going to have this surgery. You're going to start dialysis and that will save your life and you will be okay. But like you said, when you're going through the motions, you're just doing what you have to do because the doctors are telling you this is what's next. And the, not to use the word crash again, but like the crash almost happens post-transplant. You're like, what just happened? What did I go through? Holy cow. Like understanding how close you were to dying and, how did that, once you, I get, I mean, it does take time to wake up and realize what we've been through post-transplant and really find kind of get rid of that fog. But I mean, how did you deal with that realization that you're here, you're alive, you have a portion of someone's liver, and you're going to be physically okay?
Yeah, it was a shock, right? Like
Yeah.
I woke up and I, had a tube in my throat and I had no idea what had happened, and I just saw my parents looking down at me and I was like, oh, this isn't good. It took me like at least 24 hours for it to really register, like, okay, I've had major surgery, I'm alive. And like that was pretty much all I could grasp at first. And it's taken me quite some time to really understand, the gift that I received. Like, it wasn't that I didn't understand that it was a gift when I first woke up, but
Right.
like
Yeah.
to really comprehend, I received a liver from a deceased donor. So while my life was being saved, someone else's family was losing a life. And so carrying that has been both like very difficult, but also kind of a fresh perspective that gave me a lot of the motivation and courage that I needed to be able to say, like, okay, what happened here was not like this was not okay. Like, I was not feeling well. I wasn't able to advocate for myself before, but when I woke up, I was like, I need to talk to somebody about how I've been feeling and I need to get some help. And
Wow.
without going through that process, I don't think I would have had that kind of renewed lease on life to be like, okay, somebody gave a gift so big and so meaningful here that I can't waste it.
Wow. And I mean, yeah, that's almost who knows who your donor was, but putting that out there, like I've gotten this incredible gift from you, and now it's my turn to stand up and fight for myself. Because, I mean, really, like we've talked about with Sasha, and like I talk about with a lot of people, we brush a lot of it under the rug and just, well, I'll move on because I'm here, and people have said that I can do this by going outside in the sunshine or not doing certain things. And it's, I don't mean to laugh about that, but there's all of this toxic positivity that's in the world that we can fix ourselves by certain things that we do. And I think it's really brave and really hard to say, okay, I've done all of the stuff that doesn't actually work, that we know doesn't work. How do I get to a place now where someone can discuss finding a healthy mental state for me? And now that I have a physical body that is going to work hard for me and keep me physically healthy, how do I then take that next step? So what was that? I mean, we keep talking about next steps, but once you've recovered physically from your transplant and you've decided this is the next step in my journey, what, how did you then, what tools or strategies did you use to advocate for yourself?
Yeah, so I mean, waking up there, I just want to touch on this because you mentioned it. Like, there is a bit of pressure to kind of wake up and just feel grateful, right? Yes. Like to just feel overwhelmingly grateful and nothing else.
Yes.
And it also took me some time really to like process how I felt when I woke up. Like I did feel incredibly grateful, but I also woke up in a body that didn't feel like mine. Yes. I had swollen a lot as a result of, you know, leading up to the procedure and receiving the procedure. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, I didn't feel like me, and I had to hold space for both of those things at the same time, right? Like feeling grateful and feeling limited and not feeling like myself and having to take medications that my body wasn't used to. Mm-hmm. But I think like the real change was that I had, like I said, that kind of confidence and credibility to say, okay, clearly things are not okay. Like if I've gone through this mental health struggle and I've ended up with a transplant, then like something is not okay. Mm-hmm. And so I went in kind of guns blazing to my doctor and I said, I need some sort of mental health referral and I need to be taken seriously. And for the first time, you know, I was taken seriously and I was put in touch with a psychiatrist at CAMH. And, you know, I had said to him when I first met him, you know, I've tried to meet with other psychiatrists and mental health professionals, and I've tried to tell them what I think like my diagnosis should be. And they've always said, you know, I don't want to know, just tell me like how you're feeling and we'll go from there. Mm-hmm. And he was the first person that actually said, you know, I want to know what you think is like, I want to know what you think your diagnosis is, because that tells me something about what it is you're experiencing. And so I told him, you know, I think I have bipolar disorder. I've thought this for a very long time, but I've always been told that there's, you know, one criteria on this checklist that I don't meet or another criteria on another checklist that I don't meet. And so I'm wrong. And he said, no, you're absolutely right. You have rapid cycling bipolar disorder. Wow. And that diagnosis completely changed my life. Mm-hmm. I'd said to you, like, I have these core beliefs, and those core beliefs are still there, but I had never really understood how people could like wake up in the morning and just be content, right? Like just wake up and not overly happy, not overly sad, but just like neutral and content. And I had never experienced that.
Wow.
And after getting that diagnosis and getting the proper medication and working with the right, you know, mental health support people, I can say today, like, I'm 8 years sober and I wake up and I know what contentment feels like. And I don't think that would have happened for me were it not for this transplant journey and everything that came afterwards.
Yeah. Incredible. I mean, and it's hard to understand. I think from like an outsider perspective, like what do you mean you don't wake up feeling neutral? Like how can you wake up and already have those thoughts about yourself before you've even started a day? And I mean, again and again, it's incredible the bravery you've had and the persistence to say, this is not okay. I don't feel like I should feel. Somebody needs to help me. And unfortunately, it took this physical challenge to get you the right, you know, help and support that you needed. Thank goodness it did get you to where you are now. But I mean, thinking about all of these barriers that you had to knock down to finally get a diagnosis, and whether that was a diagnosis that you were hoping for or that you didn't want, you know, this similar to kidney disease, like I didn't want to be told that I had renal failure. But I finally had an answer to what had been going on in my entire life, like not feeling like every other kid on the playground and feeling sick and feeling like I don't have enough energy to do things when all of my peers were, they seemed fine. And so, yeah, the diagnosis wasn't a nice diagnosis, but, you know, having that, somebody actually finally affirming that this is something, it's not nothing. This is something. Here's your diagnosis. And now the next step is let's treat this diagnosis. I mean, amazing that you got there. Shouldn't have taken you as long as it did, you know, knocking on that healthcare system. But I mean, there's so many things that we don't understand about mental health and so many things that are difficult to navigate. I mean, you've just talked about so many of them. If we were, you know, talking to the general public, what do you wish that other people understood better about mental health? We have a pretty good understanding of different types of physical health issues, but what do you wish people understood better about living with mental health issues?
It's a really good question. Physical health is very clearly identified as a health issue, and mental health is not always identified as a health issue. Addiction is not always identified as a health issue. And I think there is still, you know, an incredible amount of stigma around mental health issues. And so, you know, I can really relate to what you were describing in terms of the relief of getting a diagnosis, right? Like, I think a lot of people can relate to the relief of getting a physical health diagnosis, like that validation that you're experiencing something in your body that you may not know how to articulate, but somebody else can help you put a name on it and say, okay, now I can help you get through this. Mm-hmm. And with mental health issues, it's very, like, it was very similar for me, right? Like, being able to put a name to how I was feeling, which allowed me to find a solution to help me live with what I was feeling, was incredibly, like, it was filled with relief. Mm-hmm. But there's also the added stigma of getting a mental health diagnosis that right. doesn't necessarily exist in the physical health world.
Right.
And so I think, like, we need to do a better job, everyone, and like myself included, with starting to understand that, you know, not really many people are quote unquote normal. Everybody is struggling with something, particularly when it comes to mental health. And so opening that door and like bridging the gap between the physical health system that we have, which is phenomenal in Ontario, and what we can offer mental health wise so that we can treat the whole person and not just the body.
Yes, I love that. Treat the whole person. There's lots of people who come to the podcast for different reasons, but if somebody was listening today and they were struggling with their mental health, what would you want to tell them?
I think what I would want them to know is, like, you know your mind and your body best. So always advocate for what you need, not just from doctors, but from friends and family members who can help you to advocate. Mm-hmm. Like, I know for me, I lived for years in the isolation and the darkness, and I didn't want anyone to know how I was feeling because I felt like it was something wrong with me. And I didn't think anybody else felt the way that I felt, you know, same with, you know, my drinking. I didn't think anybody else drank the way that I drank. I didn't want anyone to know. But what I've learned through, you know, sharing my experience is that I'm not alone in how I'm feeling, and that there is help out there if I'm willing to ask for it.
And I mean, that's almost the hardest piece, right? Is to actually ask, to be vulnerable and to say, hey, I actually do need help. I don't know how to keep doing this myself, because, you know, none of us are on an island here. We need our support systems. We need, whether it is the healthcare system or, you know, even closer to home, whether it's our friends and family. You're not helping yourself by not speaking up. It's not an easy way to live. And like you said, advocacy is so important too. And I guess this is kind of a hard question to answer, but how did you become so brave, and how did you become such an advocate for yourself? Like, how would somebody, I guess, start advocating for themselves if they felt shy or felt, you know, nervous about doing that?
I think for me, you know, I am truthfully one of those people that is like, asking for help is the last thing I want to do. I will avoid it at all possible costs. But I've had some life experiences where I haven't had a choice but to ask for help. Right. And so, you know, my transplant was one of those experiences. When I woke up that morning, like, I didn't want to call 911. I didn't want to call my support system and say, this is what's going on, but I didn't have a choice. Right. But from those experiences, you know, I had to kind of prove to myself that if I reach out for help, is somebody going to answer? And over time, you know, I started small. I started asking for help with little things, or I started in smaller communities where, you know, I didn't have to be my whole self. I could just be a little piece and say, hey, have you ever felt this way too? But really, like, just taking a chance on it, right? Like, not being super brave and super full of courage and like storming down the door, but just like a little knock to a friend and saying, like, hey, I'm having a bad day. Like, it started really small for me. And sometimes, like I said, it started without choice, but it did show me that there are people there and that I am not alone in the way that I'm feeling, and that really, like, people answer and people want to help. Like, that's the other biggest piece that I learned, is like, whether it's within the healthcare system or outside of the healthcare system, in like personal supports, family members, friends, like, people like to help other people.
Yes. And people don't always, number one, know that you need help, but number one, or number two, also know what you need, right? And so once you do kind of activate that and say, I need you to come for a coffee with me and sit down because I don't feel like myself today. Or when I was on dialysis, my brother was incredible because he knew his role in my world, and that was to bring humor and to be the silly one, and sometimes really dark, really like bad humor that we probably shouldn't, you know, publicize some of the things we would laugh about. But he knew his role, and, you know, he had come over one day, and I was in the dark in my room with a movie on that I had a classic movie that I would always watch whenever I just didn't feel like myself. And he came in and he was like, oh, you know, this is not the space or the time for me to be what I normally am, like the comic that comes in. And I was expecting him to come in and, you know, try to be funny and try to lighten the mood. And he just, you know, sat down and then eventually just laid down in the bed beside me and said, do you want to laugh today? Or do you just want me to watch this movie with you? And I said, I just want to watch a movie today in the dark. It's like, okay. And so stayed there with me. And, you know, that was really amazing too, because he had shown me, you know, it doesn't, you don't always have to have the best day. You don't always have to laugh every day. Sometimes you can sit in your dark room and watch a movie, but knowing that he was there, even though he wasn't doing anything, meant so much in that moment that he stayed. Maybe it made him uncomfortable to not, you know, be the clown that he normally is, but, you know, he was there for me, and just knowing that there was somebody like that who was willing to just, you know, sit beside me physically and just be there while I just wanted to be in another place. I think it's important for people who we love to also kind of, you know, be brave as well in that stance and to ask us, like, what is it today that you need?
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess, you know, our final thing, you talked a little bit about this with, you know, people who are struggling with their mental health as well. Is there a message that you would want to send out, either about organ donation or mental health? Maybe a question that I didn't ask you that you want to leave people with?
Yeah, I guess on the organ donation front, I would just say, you know, and on the mental health front, I think, like, we have these ideas of what mental health looks like, what mental health treatment looks like. We have ideas of who an organ donor is or who an organ recipient is. And I just think it's important to remember that, like, these things touch everyone from every walk of life with every age. And so I think organ donation is one of the greatest gifts that people can give. And I think, you know, being a recipient of an organ, like, it truly changes people's lives. And I can't think of something in my life that is as great a gift as that has been. Maybe my sobriety, but they're both pretty high up there.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Mary, for coming on the podcast today and being so open and vulnerable with us, because we don't get to hear that as often as I think most of us should hear. And we don't get to talk about that as often as we should. We often, you know, put it in the closet and leave it for another time. And I think it's so important in every day, whether, you know, we're experiencing it ourselves or have people in our lives experiencing it to be able to talk about it, because there are a lot of people out there who are going through things. And like you said, we just bottle it up and don't talk about it. So hearing somebody else go through this and have such a powerful, brave journey of advocacy for yourself, I think is going to be really amazing for people to hear and really help others along their journey too. So thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please rate, leave us a review, and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you're listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, please reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca. For information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Bespoke Productions for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.